All eyes, please. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Be seated. Thank you. Good morning. Welcome to the Idaho Supreme Court. Convening today in the Nez Perce County Courthouse. We are appreciative of the assistance of our clerk of the court and all here locally who have made our visit comfortable and made it easy to help the counsel spend the same for you. Today, the first case we have on the docket is Horton v. Horton, an appeal brought by Appellant Desiree Horton, represented by Monica Flood Green. And the respondent, Andrew Horton, is represented by Kevin Wade. Counsel, do either of you have preliminary matters for us prior to argument?
I do not,
I believe that on page 8, just a correction to the transcript on page 8 of the district court transcript of June 9th, 2020, line 19, it says, we made other decisions along the way as well. Those should be E, according to Judge.
E is who, I'm sorry?
E would be Judge Van Daly.
Any objection to that change?
Are you talking about the transcript?
The transcript of the June 9, 2020 hearing before Judge Christensen. It says, beginning line earlier, but I think the point of all this, and we made other decisions along the way as well, really should be P.
I'm sorry, I don't have that right in front of me. I would have to.
If you have any objection, just note with the court, it does appear in context. Judge Christensen was involved in making decisions lately, so to be accurate, note that.
It's just so out of context, I can't speak.
Okay. Very well. Thank you, then. Ms. Brennan, you may proceed. Let's set a deadline of 7 days, please, if you have an objection.
Oh, okay. I just would need to kind of ruffle through, and I don't want to waste your time doing that, so I apologize. Good morning, Your Honors. I appreciate you hearing this matter. This is an important matter with regards to the rights of my client, Desiree Horton. She would have liked to have been here today, but she is still living in Europe. She's still living in Italy, Vincenzo, Italy. So she did not file for the court hearing today, especially in light of the fact that we didn't know whether or not it was going to be in person or via Zoom and so forth. These parties were married for a really long period of time. Mrs. Horton was in the military for a period of time prior to getting married, and then she married Mr. Horton, who was also in the military. She moved over to Europe to live with Mr. Horton while he was stationed there, and then they had separated and had been separated for quite some time. And then in December of 2017, she filed for a divorce. She was the party moving forward on trying to obtain a divorce at that time. She was attempting to have Mr. Horton served. He was overseas, and so there was a little bit of a delay caused by that. But at the beginning of these proceedings, Mrs. Horton was the person who was always wanting to move the case forward. Mr. Horton appeared in February of 2018. It's seemingly quite some long time ago, then the trial was set fairly quickly in June of 2018. In June of 2018, Mrs. Horton complained that she wasn't ready to go to trial on all of the issues because all of the issues had not been fleshed out with regards to some of the military benefits that were entitled to her, including retirement benefit, accrued leave, and so forth. At that time, Mrs. Horton was not even thinking of, I believe, about the 2020 benefits. She wanted to proceed and go through and get her divorce. the parties did, there were a lot of issues with regards to this divorce, but the parties did get resolved, and so they put all of their resolutions on the record. With regards to military benefits, the parties agreed that they would use an expert named Mr. Stemmingson, that's in Spokane, who apparently helps draft decrees that are uncontested for the military. After the parties left and they had their agreement, Mrs. Horton then attempted to get, the parties both attempted to get Mr. Stenningson. Some of this is not necessarily in the record, but they attempted to hire Mr. Stenningson to prepare the decree. And at that time, we did not know that all military benefits and retirements or entitlements were allowed to Mrs. Horton. And the court had stated in the hearing when we were putting the stipulations on the record that the court was going to wait and retain jurisdiction over all military. At that time, we were only talking about military retirement benefits. Mr. Stenningson only puts the paperwork together with regards to anything that's uncontested. So in attempting to obtain information with regards to the wording that needed to be in military retirement benefit, Mrs. Horton hired an expert named Mark Sullivan to make sure that her rights were being preserved in just the drafting of the decree. Once she hired Mark Sullivan with regards to the drafting of the decree, this was ended up being around August of 2018. He advised her of all of her military benefits that needed to be included into the final decree in order for it to be processed.
Let me ask the question just to clarify some of the dates. As you began this conversation, you indicated that Mrs. Horton filed for divorce in December of 2017. If I look at the record, it's actually September of 2016. Is that correct?
Well, she did initially file into September of 2016, and then Mr. Horton was actually still over in Europe, and so there was some issues with regards to getting him served. They were talking about doing an uncontested divorce at that time. So, yes, she did. My recollection with regards to that was then that one got dismissed, and then we had to refile in 2017 another petition.
That's not correct. I don't see that in the record. It looks to me like, our case record begins with a complaint for divorce, 9/22/2016, James Vernon and Weeks.
That was me. I just didn't recall. There was a delay at the beginning with regards to service, and I think that at the time the parties were planning on doing a stipulated divorce, and so it wasn't supposed to be a contested divorce. So I'm not remembering back that far now, but there was a delay. My recollection was that I either refiled the petition or I ended up filing a summons and deciding to just serve it in December of 2017. And then Mr. Horton was actually here in town for the holidays, so we were able to serve him at that time.
And when is it that Mr. Sullivan, the expert, gets hired?
Mr. Sullivan was hired after the parties entered their stipulation on the record.
Stipulation for?
Well, they stipulated to all of the property and assets and so forth, except for anything having to do with military benefits, was my understanding.
So the benefits expert got hired after the parties agreed to settle the divorce?
He was hired after, yes.
This was during the period in which the court had retained jurisdiction?
Yes. So the court retained jurisdiction over what I thought was going to be a military retirement benefit, and we thought it would just be a matter of kind of processing the numbers. At that time, we discovered that there were because it wasn't, because Svenningson basically couldn't just process it that way, it needs to actually be in the decree of divorce. It's not like a quadro where you have a decree of divorce and then you do the quadro, which is a domestic relations order after. It turned out that Svenningson couldn't process it the way that it was, and so, and because it didn't mention all of the military community assets, they just weren't mentioned. So then, yes, he was hired afterwards, but it was an issue that it was my understanding the court had retained jurisdiction over. To be fair, I don't think that we realized that there were other assets out there that were that a spouse is entitled to in the military until Mark Sullivan got involved. However, I do think that it's appropriate for the court to, if we find out that there's some asset that wasn't included in the divorce questions, they'll have a divorce and there'll be like 250 items of property, and then you find out, okay, well, we forgot to include this asset. And so to bring that asset in and make sure it gets divided properly so that we're not having an asset out there that's not divided by the court, is wholly appropriate, and it is something that happens, I would say, on a regular basis, but it does happen often. So this would, some of the items that we're talking about were kind of discovered as an undivided community asset after the parties entered into their stipulation, but it came out under the umbrella of military retirement. So it wasn't until after the June 2018 setting that I asked the court to retain jurisdiction over any military benefits and not just retirement benefits, because previously we'd only been talking about retirement benefits. I don't think that either party knew that there were other community assets that had not been included in the property inventory sheet. So it wasn't just my client that didn't know. I don't think that Mr. Horton knew either. And so that was not really discovered until after Mark Sullivan was hired. So once Mark Sullivan was hired, he filed an affidavit. Initially I filed an affidavit saying, please don't enter this decree because it's not including all the military assets and it is not going to be acceptable for processing by DFAS. And at that time, it was when Desiree first said, well, I'm almost just a year away from getting my 2020 benefits, and could the court consider staying the divorce, entering the divorce until after the 20-year mark for our marriage so that I can get these 2020 benefits. And Judge Van Galen at that hearing said, well, I don't know of any authority to do that, but if you can get some authority to do that, I will consider it. And so that was when the Bird versus Bird case was cited. There wasn't any Idaho authority on point, but Bird versus Bird is a case that's persuasive when there is no direct authority on point in the state of Idaho.
But in Bird versus Bird, didn't the military spouses agree to a date of divorce? Did they stipulate to it?
I think that it was not. I do think that is the case, Your Honor. I think they did agree to it. However, it basically set the groundwork for there to be an ability to stay, basically legal authority to stay, so that we're not like committing a fraud, so to speak, on the federal government. Like, they can agree to stay it.
Bird versus Bird did not stand for the premise that the court could force a spouse to wait.
I agree with that.
To obtain a divorce.
I agree with that. I don't think that in that case the court was waiting to force a spouse to stay divorced. And I don't think that Judge Van Galen was necessarily waiting to force a spouse to stay the divorce. I just think that there was hearing after hearing after hearing where the parties were still disagreeing about the wording in the decree, and it just ended up happening to be, even though we had asked for it, it ended up happening to be that it got entered in October, and then the judge decided to remove the non-pro-tunk, which I think he had the discretion and the authority to do that. If he had the year before said, I'm going to stay these proceedings for a year so that Desiree can get her to her 2020 benefits. I do think that that would have created a little bit of a different issue, but just the way that it ended up being hearing after hearing, and it just kept dragging out. They still weren't divorced yet at that time. So it just ended up coincidentally having to be after the 2020 anyway. And I will put forth that that was not because of Desiree dragging it out or doing nothing. Every single hearing that was set that year between 2018 and 2019, or 2017 and 2018, was set by me. So I was actively moving the case forward. I was actively setting hearings to enter the decree. In February of 2018, I submitted a proposed decree with some authority on the sidelines with regards to saying, well, this language isn't going to work for this reason, and then citing the authority as to the reason that it would not work. And then also there was an affidavit submitted by the expert Mark Sullivan as to why that couldn't get processed, and it has to be in the decree. It can't be in a post-decree order.
I'm a little confused, counsel. It seems like in most divorces, the parties are in a hurry to get divorced, and then they're not in a hurry to get their property divided, and that tends to languish on. In this case, you're telling me that the parties were in a hurry to get their property divided, but they were kind of, at least one of them, wanted to wait so you could qualify for the 2020. Is that correct?
I think initially Desiree was in a hurry to get the divorce. She was the person who filed. She was the person that was trying to move it forward. She was the person that was trying to get Andrew served. She thought they had a stipulation at one point. I only think that when it got very kind of close to the 2020 that she then would have preferred to wait a year. I wasn't stringently arguing for it at that time because I didn't think you could force somebody to stay married for a year.
Right.
I didn't delay the proceedings. I was moving forward.
So the point of this is what I'm getting to is I can understand why your client may have had an incentive to have that postponed, but why should we find that the husband didn't in good faith believe that there was an agreement that would result in him being divorced at the time? Because I can't see any incentive for him to have his property divided without actually having a divorce granted to him.
Well, I mean, sometimes the divorce just gets, you have a trial set that day, and so you just put everything on the record that you can put on the record at that time, and I don't think that there was any indication at that time that he was excited or wanting to move forward and get divorced right away. I don't see any indication that that was the case.
I mean, I represented men and women in divorces, but I can't think of any man that I ever represented that said, yeah, go ahead and let's divide the property, but let's stay married. I just don't recall that kind of agreement ever being proposed.
I don't think that that was the case. Outside of what's in the record, I do have a lot of information about what's kind of going on there. But I think the bigger problem is that the language with regards to dividing military assets that has to be processed by DFAS has to be in the divorce decree itself. So no one really anticipated, hey, we can't do a post-divorce order, so to speak. And so that was not discovered until we talked to both Svenningson and Sullivan. So while, yes, he may have wanted to be divorced, when it finally did happen that the divorce decree was entered in February of 2018, there was no real reason to do a non-proton. I mean, there was no evidence that Andrew either was planning on getting married, or there was some reason why he wanted to be divorced, backdated to June. So there wasn't the judgment at his discretion had the ability to either put in a non-proton for good reasons, which would be the purpose of doing justice, as I stated in the Ward case. And in that case, I think in February just kind of made the snap decision, well, I'm going to issue this non-proton, but you can file a motion to reconsider. So then that had synthetic cause.
Wait a second. You said the judge made a snap decision to enter it non-proton. Are you telling me neither of the parties asked for that?
I didn't think that the non-proton was being argued at that time. I don't recall either party arguing strenuously for a non-proton.
Well,
so
arguing strenuously. Did either side ask for it, whether it was strenuously or not?
I don't recall that specific. I do recall being at that hearing and asking the court to not enter it non-proton, and that when he said, well, if you, and I was trying to get him to look at that proposed decree that I filed with the correct language in there, but I don't remember necessarily the non-proton being argued strenuously by either side either way, but we did file a motion to reconsider within the 14 days that it was entered, and then argued against the non-proton and put forth quite a bit of authority with regards to that.
What is the legal standard for entering a decree, a date of divorce?
In the cases of divorce, I don't think that there's like a case on point that I could find in Idaho with regards to what the date is of the divorce. The only cases that I found were the ones that I cited to the court with regards to when you can do a non-proton and when you shouldn't do a non-proton. I think
I'm interested in it, not in this moment. I'm really after when a judge says the parties are divorced on X date, what is it? What is the legal measure that the judge is applying there? I mean, the date of a divorce is important for a lot of reasons, and it's measuring your property settlement. It's impacting benefits. I mean, so what is, when can a judge enter a divorce? What is, and what's the legal standard?
Well, I thought that initially, I've been doing this for 27 years, but initially in Idaho we would do a partial summary judgment and just get the divorce entered so that people could be divorced and then worry about the property later. And then an Idaho Supreme Court case came out, which I don't have the name of it right on the top of my head, that said that, no, you can't do that because really you have to, then you'd be maybe a year later, 2 years later in trial trying to figure out what the value of the property was on that date. Mm-hmm. And then that makes it really kind of complicated. So then they stopped doing that. They tried to make the date of the divorce be on the date that the trial was, so to speak. In this case, I think that the date of the divorce was important for some aspects, but the parties had already agreed how they were going to divide their property and what the value was of those things. So I don't think that the date of the divorce had to be on the date that they put their stipulation on the record.
Okay. But you're saying we don't have a clear standard for what is the date of divorce?
Not that I know of. It's something I could look into and see if there is a case on point. In my research of this, I didn't find any case on point with regards to when the date of divorce should be. I do know that there is that case that says that you can't, that you shouldn't get divorced and then figure out what the value of the property is later. But I do know there is that case.
You can't or you shouldn't?
I think the case said that you shouldn't do a partial summary judgment for divorce only and then worry about what the property is later, because then you're looking back a year or whatever and trying to figure out what it was a year ago, you know, and so that makes it a lot more difficult. That's my recollection of what that case said. And I think I will reserve the rest of my argument for rebuttal, unless anyone has any other questions they'd like to ask me.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Wick, when you're ready. Thank you, Your Honors. I represent Andrew Horton, who's the appellee in this proceeding. We were the appellant the last time around for Judge Christensen. Mr. Horton is in the courtroom. A few other corrections as to dates besides what came out in response to Justice Brody's question as to when the case was filed. It is a 2016 case in the Magistrates Court and District Court, and was filed, and I believe an amended complaint for divorce was filed, and that's what Mr. Horton was served with. I don't know that the difference between the complaint and the amended complaint is in any way material to any of the proceedings that have occurred here. But the hiring of Mr. Sullivan by Desiree Horton and counsel would have been in 2017, not 2018. The trial was set for 2017, not 2018. Specifically, I believe the dates were June 14 and 15 were the trial dates that were set. We had mediation May 2nd of 2017 with Ms. Roletto. That's referred to in both sets of briefs. And we had a meeting with Judge Van Balen in Chambers. I believe the date was June 12th. It's reflected, referred to in the June 14 transcript, 2017, and possibly also in the June 15, 2017 transcript. The next day, which is kind of a continuation because of technical difficulties on June 14. A lot of what we've heard and what is reflected in the appellant's briefs is really a kind of a muddling or confusion of the difference between retaining jurisdiction and reserving issues for trial. What was done here was retaining the jurisdiction, really to deal with disputes that might occur, and I emphasize might because they sometimes occur and sometimes they don't, over a wording of documents, specifically the orders that would be necessary to implement the division of Andrew's military retirement account or benefits and Desiree's federal employees retirement system account. Sometimes you get back something from the plan administrator, and I'm speaking more generally of a quadro type of context, saying, well, here's the language we want. Well, why don't you start with our form? Well, we don't have a form, but we don't like what you submit. Make these changes. And sometimes that goes through a few revisions in terms of who you're dealing with. We never got to that point in this case. The agreement that was put on the record, the agreement that was reached in mediation and written up by Ms. Roletto, and Ms. Roletto is basically the prime author of the first judgment and decree that was entered, the one that was finally entered in February 27th of 2018, non-pro-tunk to June 15th, 2017. And it was revised a little bit in light of the discussion that was put on the record on June 15, 2017. We commonly ask Ms. Roletto when she writes these things up, and there's a little bit of tweaking that sometimes goes on, can you send it to us in a Word document so that one of us can do that sort of thing? Well, we kept her name on it because she was the one who really got the agreement between the parties. And I always feel that mediators deserve credit for that, and it should show up in the record. But anyway, we never got to the point of discussing really anything with Mr. Svensson other than the fact that he hadn't been paid yet. So, and that's reflected in the transcripts, it's reflected in at least my briefs, that some of the delay here was that Desiree hadn't paid her share of the fee to Mr. Svensson for his preparation of paperwork. We pay ours. Andrew also paid what was due under the first judgment and decree of divorce, and kind of a different argument, partial performance if necessary. But Sullivan was hired after the fact, very unusual circumstances. He was Desiree's expert, obviously, in this after the fact situation. The transcript of the hearing where his name first comes up, I think it's one of the ones in the summer of 2018, reflects an attempt to shift this so that it's 50-50 borne by the parties in terms of his fees. And Judge Van Valen correctly said, no, no, you know, we had Frank's and he's the primary guy. And anything you do with Mr. Sullivan is on you, Ms. Brennan. The parties were in fact divorced. There was a statement that they were never divorced. They were in fact divorced through that first judgment and decree of divorce.
So what's the legal measure for divorce?
What's the legal measure for divorce in terms of... Technically, under what I've always understood, it is when the written decree is entered by the clerk. I've seen some situations where there's an unexplained gap in time between when the judge signs the judgment and when the clerk enters it. I don't know, it was maybe 60, 90 days years ago. But I believe it's if there's a difference, and sometimes it's the same day and it doesn't matter, but it is when it was entered. So it was entered a day after Judge Van Valen signed it. But he made it non pro tonque, which would make it effective June
15, 2017. And what was magic about that date? What occurred that date that would...
That's when the parties put their agreement on the record.
Okay,
so it was... Judge Van Valen. And while it isn't always done, it's not unusual for the court to do that, particularly where a substantial period of time has passed and people have started to act in reliance upon, you know, what they assume is their new state of legal status, even if maybe it isn't quite there yet because the paperwork hasn't been not only signed but file stamped by the clerk of court.
In June of 17, when the parties put their agreement on the record, was the party's agreement complete?
It was complete other than for the tag-along stuff that you always have when there's a retirement account that needs to be done. Usually a quadrilogue, terminology is a bit different, at least in terms of the military account. If we were to say it wasn't complete until those things are done, we would have cases where people aren't divorced for a year or two, in some instances. Most of them, fortunately, don't take that long. And we typically, in Kootenai County, we typically use Mr. Svenningson for, I would say, most of these things.
When you say most of these things, what do you mean?
Most retirement accounts, but not military. Military is unusual. It doesn't come up very frequently. But for retirement accounts, quadros, whether they're private, whether they're governmental, whatever they may be. And because he's much more familiar than any of us are, and it seems to get done a lot faster with him. But he's not in a position to do it until, one, he gets paid his retainer, and two, he has a... signed and entered judgment and decree of divorce to work with, because he needs to know, okay, when were these parties not only married, but when were they divorced? And what is the division that I'm supposed to implement?
Counsel, it's obvious that the non-proton language was important to your client. Can you explain why? In other words, did he do something to rely upon the fact that it was non-proton that he doesn't want to have jeopardized?
Well, it's important to him because his retirement benefits would begin with the date of divorce. Or the division of them is determined by the day of divorce. It's a significant...
So it's a financial interest in having the number.
There's a financial interest. Did he get married after that? No. He stayed in the military for a while afterwards, didn't retire until sometime well into 2019. I don't have that particular date, but it was after all of this, of course. I suppose that the other aspect is, depending on when I'm divorced or not divorced, how long do I need to stay in the military to make up anything, would be another aspect of this. The... Uh, And simply the finality of knowing that you're divorced. In this case, the parties were told as of, in a sense, as they were told February 27, 2018, you're divorced. And it's effective back in June of 2017. Then later, who knows what they were told with the vacating of that. Counsel argues that they're no longer divorced then and that they're still married to each other. That would be an odd situation.
I can understand the interest that someone would have in wanting to know officially when they became a free agent.
Sure.
But this sounds like it's really focused on the financial aspect of it. Is there any other aspect besides the financial aspect you're aware of?
I think simply the emotional aspect of knowing that you can move on, and the legal aspect of knowing that you can move on, and that this this marriage is over and done, and knowing that whatever you do financially, it's not just the retirement accounts per se, but it's knowing that whatever you do, you're doing this as a single person. You're not subject to that house you bought is community property, by the way, because you're still married. I think there are various aspects to that. Nothing as dramatic as he got married 3 months later and before the judge took away the number.
I guess, was that like a negotiated aspect of the settlement agreement? I mean, your client wanted the divorce and he wanted it non-proton to that date. Was that a specific point that he negotiated for and got in the settlement?
Well, I can't say it was specifically negotiated that day because nobody expected this. I think the expectation, on the contrary, was that they're going to be divorced that day or shortly thereafter. I don't think anybody really would have complained if the paperwork had been signed 2 weeks late, which might be common. And then we might have an effective date of June 30th or July 1st or whatever it might be. I don't think anybody would have gotten bent out of shape about that.
So when opposing counsel says that nobody strenuously argued for the non-proton language, do you agree with that?
No. We did ask for the non-proton language. And that was in the February 26th, 2018 hearing. There are a couple places where that discussion comes up. And it's clear that Judge Van Valen was of that mindset as well.
So this wasn't something he sua sponte did. This was something you asked for.
It was something I asked for. I also asked at an earlier hearing, it might have been the one in July of 2018, when suddenly new issues are coming up for the first time that, hey, we need to get this order entered. And here it is. Well, it was the August one. It was one of those two in 2017 that we tendered the same document up to Judge Van Valen and said it, you know, should be entered now. May have used the wording unprotunct at that point, but it's one of those things, I think, that the more time that goes by, the more you look at, all right, they really did this as of June 15, 2017, that would be the appropriate date to use.
I want to shift gears slightly. Mm-hmm. One of the things that is interesting about this case is this notion of retained jurisdiction. And as I read the transcript and I read the decisions, I'm left with questions about the decision that was put on the record in June of 2017, whether it was complete, whether it was entitled to be treated as a final decision of the court, and I'm wondering, is there any legal authority for this notion of retaining jurisdiction to complete some other tasks? I mean, because military retirements in particular are interesting in that you've got, as I understand it, you have to have more ducks in a row, and you've got to have language in the decree itself. It's not like a quadro that can be entered after a divorce decree. You've got to put it in the decree itself. So, I mean, do we have a final agreement between these parties in June of 18?
We do have a final agreement. And I think that going to your question about military retirement, I think it's the same general concept that governs retirement accounts, whether, you know, whatever variety they may be. You do what you need to do to implement this as a practical matter when the question comes up. We never had anything come back from DFAS, Department of Finance and Accounting Services, I think that stands for. Material through Desiree's expert, Mr. Sullivan, and nothing of substance really from Mr. Svensson because they haven't been paid yet. But I think that normally that's all in terms of the quadro document itself.
I want to follow up on Justice Brody's question. And to the point, if there's an oral agreement, there isn't a judgment. And if there isn't a judgment, there's no such thing as retained jurisdiction. It's really a misnomer to talk in terms of retained jurisdiction if there hasn't been a judgment.
Well, I think Judge Van Dalen was saying, as trial judges routinely do, judgment is to be prepared consistent with the agreement that's put on the record. Written document be prepared for my signature. And in this case,
there isn't a judgment. There's not a judgment on June 15th, 2017.
Well, there isn't because
there are things left to be done.
No, there are not things left to be done other than the military retirement account in the first. There were things we came to the transcript that day.
Why would a judge need to retain jurisdiction if there's no judgment?
Because he anticipates that there may be issues as to the wording of something like a quadro or a military pay order. Those things happen all the time.
I understand that, but to Justice Cummings' point, retained jurisdiction is really a misnomer here, as far as I'm concerned.
That is possible that it's a misnomer, but it's the language that we've all been using.
Sure, I understand that, but to say that he's retaining jurisdiction is interlocutory for a stipulation to have been made and not reduced to writing and no judgment resulted. Everything's interlocutory at that point, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I think that technically it may be interlocutory until the written judgment is signed. And in this case, it was made non-pro-tunk to June 15, 2017, which I'm not going to say that's a common practice, but it's not an uncommon practice.
And I'm not really trying to be critical of the process. I understand the process and how it transpired, but I just don't know that it's precisely correct to say what the judge did was retain jurisdiction.
Okay.
It's interlocutory at that point, and he's trying, we think we have a deal, and that has to be reduced to writing, and it has to result in a judgment. But none of that has happened yet. So to say that the judge is retaining jurisdiction is, I think, premature.
Perhaps. I think that it simply reflects the practicalities that we deal with in these situations. We should call it something else.
Do the family law rules even contemplate this type of action? I realize in most civil cases we have all kinds of things we're dealing with, these kind of partial decisions. I mean, we would have, you know, Rule 54B type of judgment. We would have the family law equivalent of Rule 60B. Mm-hmm. There's omitted asset motions, which are common, I believe opposing counsel was alluding to.
Right.
So it seems like we've created this thing that really the rules don't contemplate because there's other rules that are designed to take care of these issues.
I cannot think of a rule that specifically mentions the concept of retained jurisdiction. It's simply been a practice in the courts for a long, long time.
So I guess my question is, why are we creating something outside the rule when there's mechanisms within the rule to deal with issues like this?
Well, I'm not sure that the mechanisms within the rule are all that the existing ones are all that geared towards this. I mean, that's kind of why you have other procedures sometimes developed that, you know, you go back into
procedures and practices.
Practices which then sometimes become implemented in procedures. Courts of equity developing in response to perceived inadequacies in common law remedies, that sort of thing.
Wouldn't the family law rule equivalent, I mean, it was 809 mm-hmm. at the time of this case, Rule 60, why wouldn't that be enough to deal with any issues in the final decree that if it's submitted to DFAS and they send it back and say, this isn't going to work, you bring your motion and you say, Judge, we're going to fix this. This is an inadvertent mistake.
I think the problem with that can be people sometimes object to Rule 60B motions as not coming within Rule 60B or whatever the basis for the objection may be. And I think what the courts are trying to do, it's not just Judge Van Dalen here, but it is magistrates generally in encountering these situations, is avoid that process. It is similar to what I've also seen happen, I don't think the rules cover this either, but sometimes people go to trial or they have an agreement and they foresee the possibility that there may be a modification coming at some point, whether it's in 6 months, a year, whatever. They know that something's likely to change, and they provide, or the judge rules, that if this happens, either one of you or this party, whichever one it may be, does not have to allege a substantial material change in circumstances to come back in here on modification. We'll just pick it back up. And that may not be entirely kosher with the rules either, but it is what the reality on the ground sometimes is. And I think that what happens with retained jurisdiction is a similar sort of thing. It is an eye towards practicality that we know we may have to do something. We don't want to force somebody to go through a potentially cumbersome procedure. And we just want to deal with it. Hey, Judge, here's what it is. We'll set it for hearing if we need to, if we don't quite agree on it, or if we don't agree on it. And but we don't have to go through a reopening of the case and a formal filing of a Rule 60B motion and meet those requirements. It's basically setting it up in advance that this will be considered regardless of how it may fit with Rule 60B.
But isn't this practice really, from an outside observer, I see that the practice is creating a real practical problem for your client. Your client wants to say, our deal was done in June of 2017. Don't talk to me about accrued leave. Don't talk to me about spousal benefits. Right. Don't talk to me about any of that. We had a deal.
That's right.
If the court were to craft an opinion that says this notion of retain jurisdiction to deal with all these issues, all this kind of thing, if we put a stop to that and said, look, the judgment is the judgment is the judgment, and if you want to change it, file your Rule 805 motion. This is the way that we do it. I mean, that to me seems like it's the cleanest way to deal with it. Yeah, I mean, is it cumbersome? Sure. Then Mrs. Wharton's going to have to step up and explain why it's an omitted asset or why it isn't an omitted asset. That to me is one of the problems. I mean, as an outside observer, I see that the retained jurisdiction problem creates the tension in the case.
And that may be. I'm just answering the questions in terms of what is the common practice.
Right.
It does put me in a little bit of an odd situation of defending Judge Van Dalen, at least on this aspect of it. But I certainly understand where he was coming from, because I've seen judges do that frequently. That wasn't the issue we really had with Judge Van Dalen in terms of the practicality of it. There were the other issues.
You're not faulting him for doing what you asked him to do.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Wade, can I jump to the issue about the language in the decree about the PERS account? The language you advocated for differs from the language you put on the record in June 2017. So help me understand how the district court erred in sending that issue back and saying, you know, you replaced this language, you shouldn't have.
The language that I came up with later was in response to language that Desiree and her counsel came up with about the FERS account. If you look at the language in the June 15th, 2017 transcript where it's put on the record and the initial judgment, they don't have that language about the FERS account. It's just mere language. We thought a language for the military retirement benefits, and then we copied that for FERS in mediation and in the discussion with Judge Van Dalen. I think it's fair to say nobody was thinking about the complexities that we later encountered. We later were faced with an argument that Desiree brought up, that, hey, some of that FERS account is separate, my separate property, because it was earned before the marriage. And Andrew's response, and all of this is in the later hearings, it comes out in two or three of them, and Andrew says, but hold on, you cashed that out, that pre-marriage part, and then we bought it back during the marriage, so it should all be community property. Oh yeah, I guess you're right. So that was the basis upon which I asked for that language later, which Judge Van Dalen agreed in the earlier hearing should be included. It turned out not to have been included in what was submitted to him, and so I objected.
And I don't know that I saw in any of the transcripts where Ms. Brennan or Ms. Bailey said, yeah, you're right, with mm-hmm. regard to your assertion mm-hmm. that Desiree had cashed this out and then they bought it back during the marriage. So can you tell me what hearing they made that concession?
Well, okay, maybe I'm reading into what they said, but certainly Judge Van Dalen adopted that. I don't think there was any disagreement that with the idea that she cashed it out and then they bought it back.
They disputed it later, right? I mean, I recall either Ms. Brennan or Ms. Bailey disputing that it happened.
I think that they were disputing. Disputing whether the language should be included about that. I don't recall a specific dispute as to whether that had happened. The buyback.
Okay, I thought I had seen in the record where either Ms. Bailey or Ms. Brennan said no, that's not what happened.
I don't recall it, but there's quite a bit there over the course of all those hearings.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, you're saying essentially, yes, I put this on the record in June of 2017, but subsequently the parties agreed to amend the decree to include this, you know, or any amount that was bought back or during the marriage.
It could be that. It could be that Judge Van Dalen simply initially agreed that, hey, if it was bought back during the marriage, then it really is community property. I know he went back and forth on that issue, as he did on other issues.
Let me ask you one more factual question. On the spousal benefit, is there any impact on the husband if Mrs. Horton is given the spousal benefit, the 55%? That is to say, is his present payment reduced? Or does it impact his ability to, for example, provide benefits for a future spouse?
I think it's both. Okay. They have to pay for it for one, and there's a complex mechanism for the payment for the benefit. And one of the difficulties we were learning about later is that placing the burden on her to pay for the benefit is not so easy when you're dealing with the military. And then secondly, it reduces his benefit. And it does obviously impact his ability to give that benefit to another spouse later on. I don't think you can do that more than once. I think my time is up unless there are other questions.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
And what kind of time remains for you, Helen?
9 minutes, Your Honor.
I just wanted to speak to a few things. I think one of the issues that specifically I wanted to focus on this appeal is whether or not the abuse of discretion standard was used by Judge Christensen. I don't think enough focus has been given on the fact that Judge Van Dillen has a lot of discretion in these cases as long as there are facts sufficient for him to make those rulings. Basically, Judge Christensen just found there were no facts that were sufficient and wholly vacated the judgment rather than saying, I'm going to remand this and you justify your facts one way or the other. Because if he hadn't just vacated the judgment and said there are no facts that I can see, then we could have gone back and put forth our briefing as to what facts were in front of the court sufficient for him to have entered that in his discretion. I don't think that the abuse of discretion standard was properly applied by Judge Christensen, and I do think that that is the primary error that happened here, basically wholly vacating the divorce, or at least ordering that the divorce be vacated. That created a situation where these parties are potentially still married. We have a written decree of divorce, but we have an order saying that that's vacated. So both parties can't even
get... What should the remedy be?
Well, he, instead of vacating it, he could have said, I don't think that you have articulated what facts you have to support this reasoning. I'm going to remand it so that you can make findings of fact and both parties can submit their briefing with regards to what facts were in the record for him to have made those rulings.
I'm confused by your argument. I'm looking at Judge Christensen's decision, and he says the following. The magistrate's decision set forth in the 10-18-18 amended judgment is vacated, and the matter is remanded to the magistrate court to make proper findings of facts concerning the date of divorce, whether the election of the survivor benefit coverage is an asset, and whether the FERS account is an asset. So it sounds like he did remand it.
Well, he did remand it, but in my reading of what you just read, basically he vacated it, and he had said that there were no facts sufficient to support the date of the divorce that he had quit. So it kind of was, well, can we go back and then be in front of Judge Van Dillen and then just, he can still make the same ruling? Or do you read that to say, this is vacated because I find there were no facts, and thus we're here in front of your honors? Because I think that it wasn't very clear, but the fact that he vacated it, he definitely made a ruling that decree with that date of divorce was not correct. So
that's what appellate courts do.
No, right, but I don't think that it was on the abuse of discretion standard. He didn't look and see if Judge Van Dillen had abused his discretion in vacating the non-pro-tunk and then entering it in October 2018.
Well, counsel, didn't Judge Christensen specifically say he could not find... The transcript does not reflect that the court recognized the issue is within the court's discretion, nor does it reflect that the court reached its decision by the exercise of reason. Aren't those two elements of the abuse of discretion test?
Yeah, those are two elements of the abuse of discretion test, but I don't think that the court actually applied the abuse of discretion test.
Counsel, he cited Lundberg versus My Fun Life in the conclusion of his decision and set forth all four prongs of that test and said all four prongs weren't met. How could that be anything other than an abuse of discretion review?
Well, what I'm saying is that he didn't cite the reason why Judge Van Dillen abused his discretion. I think that there was facts sufficient.
But counsel, he did. I just read you the sentence.
Right.
Where he said he didn't recognize it was an issue of discretion, which is element one, and he didn't there's no indication that he exercised reason, which is either element two or three. I can't remember off the top of my head. But
four.
But I'm struggling to understand how, when he calls out the four elements of the test, and then he calls out specifically the two elements that weren't met, how did he not apply an abuse of discretion standard of review?
I think that it was kind of a blanket saying, well, there was an abuse of discretion, but without analyzing the facts specifically, I guess is what I'm trying to say, just point out why it was an abuse of discretion.
So
I do think that there was facts sufficient in front of Judge Van Balen that he could find that it was a severe prejudice to my client to vacate the non-proton. And so to just kind of say it, okay, he abused his discretion, but without going through and really looking at the facts and analyzing them and sending that forth, I mean, I think that's kind of an opinion without basis.
Well, it's an opinion, but it's an opinion of a judge,
right.
which I think is worthy of some consideration. He says in the same conclusion I've been quoting that the magistrate abused its discretion by removing the non-proton language, by doing this, by doing that. So I'm just not getting your argument that there was no specificity to his ruling. It seems like it's extremely specific.
I think that there was specificity that he felt that, but he didn't, I don't think, rule on based on the facts that were in front of the court,
well,
is what I'm saying. He didn't say why that was an abuse of discretion.
But
he just said it was.
Counsel, it wasn't that there weren't facts in the record. Judge Christensen's fault was that Judge Van Balen, from Judge Christensen's view, did not explain why he was vacating the non-proton. He did not explain why he was finding the survivor benefit plan was an omitted asset and awarding it. So where in the record did Judge Van Balen set forth his reasoning for those decisions?
I see what you're saying. And I do think that that was one thing that could have happened if I hadn't filed this appeal before Your Honors. I think it could have gone back and he could have said, here's the facts that I based it on, and da-da-da-da-da. And I think there was sufficient facts in the record for him to have made those findings. So that was one thing that could have gone back. We could have gone back, but in my reading of it, I wouldn't have been able to then put forth facts after Judge Christensen's ruling and say, okay, these are my findings of fact that support my ruling, if you understand what I'm saying. Vacated the decree.
But my question to you was, where in the record did Judge Van Balen explain his reasons for making the decisions that Judge Christensen reversed and sent back?
I don't think that he specifically went through and made his reasons with regards to that, but I do think that in the whole picture that it was extreme prejudice was shown by my client for him all of a sudden putting in the non-proton when that wasn't agreed upon by the parties.
But it's a failure to explain reasoning and abuse of discretion.
I don't think that it's the failure to explain it that's an abuse of discretion, because I don't think that the court in these divorce cases and custody cases goes through and explains every single reasoning for every single item, for every single, you know, we've got 280 items or whatever. I don't think they necessarily do that. I think that they don't have to have a, you know, 50-page long written ruling in a divorce case. As long as there's facts sufficient in the record for the court to have made those rulings, I think that's where the abuse of discretion comes. I don't think that the court has to specifically articulate that
why it's doing what it's doing.
Why it's doing what it's doing.
Well, I agree with you.
For every single tiny little detail.
I agree with you. We have some case law that suggests that if the judge doesn't explain his decision, that doesn't necessarily mean it's fatal if we can tell from the record the obvious reasons why.
Yeah.
But in this case, didn't he clearly find that he couldn't discern a reason why he did that? The Van Valen.
I think that Judge Van Valen has a very casual way of speaking, but I do think that when we pointed out to him that you said, when I sign the decree, that's the date it's going to be entered, he said, well, I did say to you that I would do that, and so I'm going to stick with what I said I would do earlier. You know, basically, this was the agreement of the parties. This is what I said on the record. I'll sign it, and it'll be entered the date that I sign it. And then he had gone back on what he said he was going to do, which was essentially his ruling, and then he decided to take that away because that part was what was an abuse of discretion.
I see. Thank you.
If you have any other questions, otherwise I think I'm out of time.
Thank you.
All right.